Okay. So, last week, I just wanted to lay out the basic language of the rapture, all right? That, so Jesus dies and is resurrected and ascends into heaven. And so now we exist in this age of the church, right? When God sends the Spirit upon the people, and then we live here for however long, it's an unknown period, right, until Jesus returns. Except for those in the rapture school of thought, Jesus has a double return. The first time he returns, he comes and he takes all of the true believers and takes them up into heaven. And then there's this period of tribulation, usually considered to be 7 years. And then Christ returns again, and then there's a 1,000-year reign called the millennium. And I heard last week, I think at some point that we had the rapture could be pre-tribulation, mid-tribulation, or post-tribulation. It could happen anywhere in there. And then there's this 1,000-year reign. So, and we looked at a couple biblical passages that where they kind of the proponents of this school of thought take it, and they look at 1 Thessalonians 4, and they look at Matthew 24, and they use Daniel a lot in the midst of that. They see that Daniel's sort of apocalyptic sections pointing to this as prophecy. So that's where we were last week, and that's sort of the sense. I wanted to lay that out for everybody, all right? And I want to be really, really clear here. When I as we get into this, I'm going to talk about Lutherans don't see this rapture as a solid interpretation of the biblical witness. That's not to say that we don't believe Jesus isn't coming back. That is clear. In some ways, the argument over this isn't Jesus isn't really coming back. He comes into our hearts. There are some folks out there who don't want to talk about Jesus' return. In some ways, it's harder for them to believe Jesus is returning than Jesus rose from the dead. So I want to make sure that we're really clear here that the disagreement between the rapture school and the Lutherans and it's not just us though, it's the Lutherans, it's the Catholics, it's Episcopalians, we're not alone, it's not just us. The main disagreement here is not that Jesus isn't returning, but how he's returning and what it means. That's really the key here. So we get this, like I said, there's this twofold return of Christ. One, to pluck his people out of the tribulations, the sufferings, and the horrible time that's going to happen, and the 1,000-year reign, the millennium. So, well, there's premillennial, postmillennial, and amillennial. Lutherans and others who believe, Catholics and Episcopalians, are amillennial. That there is not going to be a literal 1,000-year reign. Remember, that came out of the book of Revelation. We read Revelation not necessarily as a literal map of exactly what's going to happen. Right? It is a deeply symbolic book. It can be read in a number of ways, and you can find credence in every single way you do it. It happens to be one of my favorite books. I think it's great. I love sort of the weird imagery and everything in there, and mainly because in Revelation, the main character in Revelation is Jesus. It's a statement about who Jesus is in relationship to the Father. Because God speaks, and then Jesus speaks, and they say the same thing. It's a very clear statement of that, you know, God and the Father and Jesus are one. So, I mean, that's really kind of at the core. And it's written in a time when Christians are being persecuted. They see crazy stuff happening with in the Roman Empire, and they write it in this code and this, you know, in language that has a multivariate way of looking at it, like looking at a gem in different lights. You know, you see different things. So that's in there. We're amillennial, though. We understand it's not a literal thing. And there's so there's another issue too, right? This idea that in that millennium, the saints are going to come back with Christ and establish an earthly government. Because this is really before the final consummation of Jesus' return. That Jesus is going to come back and create, have the saints create an earthly government. Well, I was really glad Special Guys, I learned a lot of stuff. And one of the things, I'd read it before, but I had totally missed it, but in the Augsburg Confession, Lutherans come out very explicitly already in the 16th century and say, there is no thousand-year reign. They reject, it says here, it's Augsburg Confession, Article 17. And remember, the Augsburg Confession is sort of the foundational document of Lutheranism. That's really, it sort of gives us the shape of who we are. It says that we reject opinions to the effect that before the resurrection of the dead, the godly will take possession of the kingdom of the world, the ungodly being suppressed everywhere. Now, historically, part of that happens because the Swiss reformers tried to do just that down in Switzerland. They tried to sort of recreate the kingdom of God through laws and legislation, and you know you could be taken to court if you didn't do the right things, and it's kind of like the first blue laws, but on a larger societal basis, right? So Lutherans go, that's not the right way to do it. You know, we don't rule the world with the gospel. We just know Jesus rules in the world with the gospel. But there's a big difference here. We don't do it. Jesus does. So they wanted to say very clearly there, not going to happen. We don't believe that. So let's take a look. If you grab some Bibles in the pews, you want to grab a hold. Go ahead and take. We're going to go to one of those passages, Matthew 24, and we're just going to take a look, verses 37 to 42. And there, Jesus says, "For as the days of Noah were, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day Noah entered the ark, and they knew nothing until the flood came and swept them all away, so too will be the coming of the Son of Man. Then two will be in the field, one will be taken and one will be left. Two women will be grinding meal together, one will be taken and one will be left. Keep awake, therefore, for you do not know on what day your Lord is coming." And so the rapture folks point to two will be in the field. One will be taken and one will be left. All right? Two women will be grinding meal. One will be taken and one will be left. Now remember, they have to conflate this passage with 1 Thessalonians 4. And we're going to look at that one next. But they want to squeeze those two where the people are raised up. And they're like, well, that's it. You see, this what Matthew, it's in Matthew's gospel, and Paul talks about. That's not the case, right? So they take that image of one taken, one left. The key, though, to interpreting this passage is in verse 37. No, 37, that's right. "For as the days of Noah were." The days of Noah. There's our interpretive key, right? Jesus is recalling a passage or a story. What happens in the Noah story? Right? There has been a massive, since the time of the fall, there is a massive downward spiral until no one on earth is, well, they're all reprobates. They're terrible. I mean, the world has fallen so far into sin. It's dark and it's horrible. Only one righteous man survives, and it's Noah and his family. So Jesus, so God has him build an ark, and God is going to wash the earth clean. And the waters subside, and Noah begins sort of a new earth again, one that's been washed. Who remains? Noah and his family. It's exactly the opposite of the way the people who are taken away are the wicked. The wicked and the evil are washed away in the waters of the flood. Who remains? Noah. The early church saw in this, in the Noah story, a prefigurement of the church. I went to a when I was in grad school at Penn State. There's a church there in sort of the heart of State College, and it's called Grace Lutheran Church, and it's very modern. It's very, very modern. It took a while to get used to. I was coming from a little old country church, you know, and okay. Well, anyhow, and it's huge, and it's got, and the front has that. It looks like the sort of the front end of a ship, right? And it's a very modern sort of take on the ship. If you go down to the chapel, right, the Scandinavian architecture, right? You walk inside, it gives the feel of being inside a ship, right? The Noah story gives us this idea of sort of the ark is the church saving the people from the floodwaters that destroy the wicked. Right? No, Luther picks up on this in the flood prayer when we do the baptisms about how Noah and his family were saved in the ark in the water. Right? When we baptize, we look at water as, I mean, it is a death. I mean, they're buried in the water and raised to new life. That's the image there. That's what. Too bad we only have a little. Can't really, you know, get the head. It doesn't work that way, right? But you know, that's the sense. That's the image that we're buried with Christ in the waters of baptism, raised to new life, right? So there. See right there. For us, that passage is taken and turned around for us. We get another interpretation about it. I mean, ultimately, you can argue, well, isn't their interpretation as valid as ours? Well, I think, I mean, you can sit there and argue that, but for me, I think, what does it tell us about God? Right? What is the image of God that it's portraying, right? The promise here is God is going to save, right? And God is going to take care of the wickedness in the world. I mean, that's the important part. So that Matthew 24, for me, that's one of those things that finally twists it around and I think helps us see it in an old light, but now again for us newly again. So, all right, so that's the Matthew 24 one. 1 Thessalonians 4. Jump to that. Verses 13 through 18. And there Paul writes, "But we do not want you to be uninformed, brothers and sisters, about those who have died, so that you may not grieve as others do, who have no hope. For since we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so, through Jesus, God will bring with him those who have died. For this we declare to you by the word of the Lord, that we who are alive, who are left until the coming of the Lord, will by no means precede those who have died. For the Lord himself, with the cry of command, with the archangel's call, and with the sound of God's trumpet, will descend from heaven, and the dead in Christ will rise first. Then we who are alive, who are left, will be caught up in the clouds together with them to meet the Lord in the air, and so we will be with the Lord forever. Therefore, encourage one another with these words.
Take that language, and if you take it and you're looking at it in the rapture context, I think it has to. You take it out of the context of what Paul was writing about, right?
Notice again. Here's the key for us, right? He's in 13. We do not want you to be uninformed, brothers and sisters, about those who have died, so that you may not grieve as others do who have no hope.
So the question is, in 1 Thessalonians is likely the very earliest writing in the New Testament. If you were to line them up, all the books of the New Testament together, 1 Thessalonians would be the very first one. The Gospels don't come. Mark's probably the earliest at about 70, and Matthew and Luke are in the 80 to 90, and John is 90 to 100. 1 Thessalonians is about 50. Right? So we're 20 years after Jesus' death. Right? And it is very clear in Paul's writings that he expects Jesus to come back soon, like almost immediately. But what about those who've died in the intervening periods? What's going to happen? Are they going to be raised? Is it too late? What's going to happen? And Paul is trying to write a word here of comfort and hope, so that you may not grieve as others do who have no hope, right? Notice there, it's a pastoral comment. He really wants to touch upon them, make sure they understand there's hope. There's not, and so he's saying, no. This is what the resurrection means. Not that anyone's left behind, but that we will all be together in the resurrection. And one other thing in that passage for us to hear, right? When in 17, then we who are alive, who are left, will be caught up in the clouds together with them to meet the Lord in the air.
So now, this is not like Jesus is up in heaven and he sort of comes down halfway and he raises the rest of us up, so then we all just shoot back on up. Jesus is coming down, right? The dead and the alive together meet Christ. Now, here's the thing. The word Paul uses, meet, is a technical term. It's the term of what the people of the city would do when there was a visiting royal dignitary. They would go out and meet him outside the city walls. Are they just going to, hey, how you doing? Nice to meet you. Thank you very much. Okay, go ahead. Go home to them now. No, the point is, they rush out to meet him and go back with him. It's a procession. It's a technical term. When Jesus comes down and we rise up to meet him, it's because then we're going to keep going with them back to the earth, because for Paul, the idea isn't that we're going to die and spring off to heaven. The idea of resurrection is about bringing about new creation. It's also sort of at the end of Revelation. There's a new heaven and a new earth, right? But it's not like it's completely disconnected from this earth now. Just like when we are resurrected in our state, when we are fully and completely created in the image of Christ, it's not like it's disconnected from who we were. Like, oh, well, we've thrown away the old Brian, and now there's a new Brian. It's a perfected world, right? If you've read the Chronicles of Narnia, right, there's this sense that at the end, the magician's nephew,
that there's a door that opens and they walk out into it and they realize ultimately that Narnia, it's, or this new land is where they've been all along, but it's fuller. It's more real. It's not been diminished by brokenness and sin, and we don't see it as clearly. This is what, here it is. This is it. It's an even fuller and richer reality of what we had experienced. So, finally, last one in Acts 2. Why is it that we see, why is it that we think that we're amillennial? That there is no fullness, there is no waiting, and then tribulations, and then millennial. That it's all just going to, it all extends from Jesus out until Jesus comes back, that we're living now in between these times. So, Acts 2, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it's the Pentecost story. The Pentecost story, right? The disciples are waiting for power from on high to come. They're just waiting in Jerusalem, waiting, and then comes the Spirit. Bestows on them power. They go out into the streets. It's not the speaking of tongues that Pentecostals want to hold to. It's the opposite, right? It's not ecstatic speech that no one can understand. It's the ability and power to speak the gospel so that people can hear it and understand it. And Peter, this crazy fisherman, uneducated likely fisherman, is able to get up and give this speech. And he says, men of Judea and all who live in Jerusalem, let this be known to you and listen to what I say. Indeed, these are not drunk as you suppose, for it's only 9 o'clock in the morning. No, this is what was spoken through the prophet Joel. In the last days it will be, God declares, that I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, and your young men shall see visions, and your old men shall dream dreams. And he goes, slaves are going to have the spirit, and there'll be portents in the heavens above, and signs on the earth below, blood and fire and smoky mist. The sun shall be turned to dark. And he quotes Joel about the great and terrible day of the Lord. In the last days. In rapture circles, they'll talk about the end times, and the end times are coming. The end times are coming. Right? You don't want to be caught in the end times. But in Acts 2, Peter gives us our key to seeing it all. We're in the end times now. Right? Jesus' resurrection kickstarts the end times. The end times are when the dead are going to be raised. Jesus' resurrection gets it all going. It's what opens the Spirit's floodgates to be poured out upon all flesh. And it's, yeah, there's going to be tribulations. But that's the other side of things. Never are we promised that we get out, that Christians get out of the tribulations and sufferings of the world. The rapture school, we're going to get us plucked out and we're free. So get right with Jesus and you get to be free of the rapture stuff as well. You don't have to suffer. But I think my take is the exact opposite. One of the marks of the church, Luther tells us, is that we're going to get the cross. We get to suffer along with everyone else for their sake, because then we get to stand with them and say, it says something a little bit more about the God that has grabbed a hold of us, who is present with us in our sufferings. And the great thing is, one of the things we get to point to is the time when there will be no more sufferings. But he doesn't pluck us all out of it. We go with it. knowing that God is with us even in the midst of that. There's the image of the God who is steadfast and faithful to us. Engages in the suffering of the world so that we may be released from it. The Jesus' return does, in fact, bring everything to a final and ultimate ending, a fulfillment. But I think it really does. The devil is in the details. If we hold to this image of Christ coming to save us from the sufferings, we miss the very heart of what God is doing. And it's all about us and our physical nature. It's about our resurrection, not our rapture.